Good morning, everyone, and welcome back from the long Labor Day weekend. I hope everyone had a good time off, enjoyed the extra day off, and what a way to start the month of September than with the TRI Practitioners Forum. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. Want to go ahead and get started with today's event. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. So our next call is going to be on October 2nd, so please mark your calendars. Again, October 2nd is the first Tuesday of next month, and that's when we will have October's Practitioners Forum. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly, because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today. We ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. So, we do have a lot of new attendees because we did just wrap up in August a full-day seminar, which we broadcasted a few times to accommodate the different time zones. So welcome to all of those who are attending here today that came through the August events. So welcome. So now let's go ahead and talk about what happens when we open up the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you entered it while logging on, and that you have a question. An alternative is, because what we've come to realize, a lot of you are shy and don't want to come on the line live, so you can actually type in your question in the question box itself, and I'll read it out loud and have Norman here answer it. So now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and get started. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource, both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everyone. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. On the first Tuesday of each month, like this morning, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to come back regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. And on the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. That is absolutely correct. So let's go ahead and take some of these questions. As a reminder, our VIP members take priority during these calls. So the first round of questions that you're going to be listening to have been submitted directly by VIP members. If you're interested in joining and need more information, I will be pushing information via the chat box, so you'll get those links here shortly, and I'll explain the benefits here in just a few minutes. But let's go ahead and start off with some of the questions here. You know what? I do have to mention this, because we did get some requests or questions that are tax-related questions, specifically tax-related questions that right now, because of tax season, I did not have CPAs available to join us on the call or answer these questions. So I am going to apologize to William, Melissa, and Ken, who submitted questions related to tax specific questions that we will get answered for you, by the way. But we will do it offline and send you an email And again, a couple of you are members, so you can use that consultation time to get that those questions addressed. So the ones that we will be focusing on today are resolution-related questions. So coming up with the first one here is David. He's a CPA, a member, and is asking, if the 10-year statute runs out and they cannot actively enforce collection action, will the State Department still be enforcing passport restrictions? So if one that still owes tax but the 10-year statute has run goes to Europe on vacation, will they be allowed to return to the USA even with an outstanding debt owed to the US? So I'm not sure if a lot of you are aware, but the State Department is, IRS is informing the State Department of serious delinquencies and is creating issues for passports.
So there's several questions within this question. So first of all, if the 10-year statute on collection expires, then the tax is uncollectible, and so they don't owe it. So when you ask if one that still owes tax but the 10-year statute is run, that's kind of an oxymoron, because if the 10-year statute is run, then they don't owe taxes. Now, as to the passport and being allowed to re-enter the United States, so the IRS is sending certification to the State Department for people with seriously delinquent tax liabilities, and they could be preventing them from renewing their passports. But the thing is, if you're going on vacation and you have a passport that's going to expire while you're away, you're going to have trouble getting back in the United States anyways, because your passport is expired. So you're going to have to either go to a United States consulate in whatever foreign country you are and get your passport renewed at the consulate, or the better idea is to get your passport renewed before you go, so it doesn't expire while you're away. So it seems like the question is, will they be allowed to return to the U.S. even with an outstanding debt? Well, if the statute has expired, then there is no outstanding debt, so I don't think that would be a problem. If there is outstanding debt, I would suggest that they renew their passport before they leave.
Right, and I think that's the general understanding, that it prevents you from renewing or acquiring a new passport. I don't think it does anything to existing passports.
I mean, if you have a passport, a recent one, you're okay.
Correct. All right, David, hopefully that answers your question there. If not, give us a call and use some of your consultation time to get clarification on it. Okay, moving on to Mary, who's an EA and also a member. Mary is asking, I have a longtime client for whom I've negotiated a couple installment agreements, and the IRS, like clockwork, asks for a new 433F every couple years. What can I do to stop their constant review of my client's financials? There is equity in their home, so the OIC will cause them to sell the home, and they don't want to do that.
Okay, so my guess is that whatever installment agreement you're setting up for the taxpayers is what's called a partial pay as opposed to a full pay. So it used to be where the only kind of installment agreements that the IRS would accept would be a payment plan that would full pay the outstanding tax liability before the collection statute expired. And so it would depend on how much you owe, what years you owe for, and how many years are left on the statute, and the taxpayer's ability to pay. A partial pay installment agreement means that the taxpayer doesn't have sufficient disposable income to pay their tax liability within the statute. And so because it's a partial pay, the IRS will check back every 2 years or so and want to see new financials to determine if the taxpayer is in a better position to full pay their taxes. If not, then they'll set up another installment agreement, and again, it will be partial pay. But again, they'll check it out in a couple years. If you want an installment agreement that's set up once and that's it. And the installment agreement will continue until the tax is paid off in full, which is a full pay installment agreement. Then they won't check it every couple of years. You're good. But you'd have to determine how much that would be and whether or not the taxpayers can afford to pay those monthly payments or not. But if you do have a full pay payment plan, they will not relook at it every couple of years. They'll let it run out because they know that the plan will full pay the taxes.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Becky. Becky is a CPA and also a VIP member. I submitted an offer for what I believed to be reasonable, $10,000 on $120,000 liability, and we just received the IRS letter denying the offer, stating that they believe the taxpayer can full pay the liability. If I use the standards and followed the formula, why would the IRS deny the OIC?
Okay, so a couple things. First of all, your comment that it was reasonable because your offer $10,000 on $120,000 liability, that's really not how offers are viewed. It's not how much or what percentage of the liability the offer will pay. It's what's the taxpayer's ability. And so with every offer that's submitted, the IRS does two calculations. One's called an IET, which stands for Income Expense Table. And they look at the taxpayer's income and expenses, and there's two columns. There's like income of what the taxpayer reported on their 433 AOIC, and then there's the income that the IRS calculated. That may be different, so you need to look at that. And then expense table are the expenses that the taxpayer claimed. And then there's a column of the expenses that the IRS allowed. So you want to look at that. So when they do the income expenses, they may come up with a different monthly disposable number than you came up with. And then they take that number and they multiply it by the number of months that are left within the statute for collection. So if they determine that the taxpayer can either full pay or pay more through an installment agreement that's going to last for the life of the statute, then they'll deny the offer. The other chart that they compute is called an AET. That's Asset Equity Table. And so they look at the taxpayer's assets and the equity in the assets to determine what's available for the offer. And that may increase it. So really, when you ask why would the IRS deny the OIC, the answers in the IET and AET that they completed. And if you disagree, you have 30 days or something to appeal it. And if they're incorrect, that would appeal it. And you would have another chance to show it. But without seeing their calculation, I don't know why they denied it, except that they came up with either more income or less expenses or more equity in the assets than the taxpayer did.
All right, Becky, if you need us to take a look at those IETs or AETs, we are more than happy to go over those with you, again, because you can use your consultation time as a member. Moving on to Henry. Henry is an EA and also a VIP member. I have a client that missed the audit and now has assessed additional tax. It has been over a year since the audit was performed. What is the process to have the audit reopened to show expenses?
Okay, so the lifespan of an audit consists of, first it's assigned to usually like an auditor, which is a revenue agent or something similar. And they send out a 30-day letter with their proposed tax examination changes. And if you disagree with it, you need to reply to the auditor within the 30 days. After that, they issue the notice of deficiency, and that's called a 90-day letter because it gives you 90 days to file a petition with the U.S. Tax Court. So if those events have passed, then the audit has really become final, and the only way to appeal it at this point and reopen it is to file an offer, and it's doubt as to liability rather than doubt as to collectability. And so what you would do in the offer is you would say which expense, usually it's an expense, disallowed expenses, which expenses were disallowed and why they should be allowed, and proof, you know, invoices or statements and cancel checks, and something to prove, number one, that the expenses were actually paid, and number two, that the expenses were reasonable and necessary. And you can do that in your offer doubt as to liability, and there's no time limit on that. So that would reopen the audit, and it would actually go to the appeals office, and another auditor would look at it. So that's pretty much what you would do at this point.
All right, Henry, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to Nofifa. Nofifa is an EA and is asking, how do you respond when an RO threatens to assess trust fund recovery penalty on your client and says you can only appeal?
Okay, so the proper procedure is the revenue officer sends out a proposed assessment of trust fund recovery penalty, and at the bottom is a place for the taxpayer to sign if they agree to the assessment. If they don't sign and the 60 days pass, then the trust fund recovery penalty becomes final. So if you're going to appeal it, you need to appeal it within those 60 days, and the letter enclosing the proposed assessment tells you how to appeal. You would appeal to the revenue officer who assessed the trust fund, and you would have that 60-day period. And if the revenue officer agrees with the reason for your appeal, they can change the assessment. If they don't, then they send it to the appeals office, and then you'd be dealing with an appeals officer, and you'd state why you think the IRS was incorrect in assessing the trust fund against that particular person.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Bernice. Bernice asked the question regarding a C corporation. Says a C corporation is no longer in business but owes about $40,000 in payroll taxes. Please advise the best option to resolve this client's tax debt. The owner is a sole owner with a W-2 job.
Okay, so if I understand this correctly, a C corp owes payroll taxes, but that C corp is no longer in business. So then the question, well, they can only collect the payroll tax from the C corp, but they probably assessed the trust fund against a responsible person. And if the owner was the sole owner, then they would probably have gotten assessed the trust fund recovery penalty. So if they've got assessed the trust fund recovery penalty, then they need to submit financial, either 433F if it's with ACS, or 433A if it's a revenue officer, where they would determine the taxpayer's ability to pay, and the trust fund recovery penalty would be paid based on the taxpayer's disposable income, and that trust fund recovery penalty becomes uncollectible after 10 years.
All right, Bernice. Now, also keep in mind the trust fund recovery penalty is roughly about half of the original tax liability, the payroll tax liability.
Right. It usually, not always, because if some payroll taxes were paid, with the return or with federal tax deposits. They actually apply those payments first to the non-trust fund portion. So I've seen a case where the remainder of the payroll tax liability was all trust fund. So, but normally it's about half, but it could be anywhere from at least half to 100%, depending on what the corporation paid in federal tax deposits and with the returns.
All right, Bernice, hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to Corey. Corey is an EA and asking the question, I have a client that during the process of an audit, it was determined that he had not paid or filed payroll taxes for many years. For the early years, he was the main employee. He's an officer of an S Corp, but then had 2 to 3 employees. So he is looking at not having paid around $200,000, $300,000 in payroll taxes. The audit was originally for the years 2013 and 15, and now they are expanding. We recreated the payroll taxes for the audit years and were about to file them, but the auditor told us not to, since she was still looking into it, possibly upping the salary for the officer. Should we file them anyway?
You know, I wouldn't, because filing those returns is kind of like an admission that that the taxes were not filed but owed, and it could come back to bite you. And so I would wait until the I don't think it would be a revenue officer, probably revenue agent doing the audit. I would allow the revenue agent to complete the audit and not file the returns while an audit is pending. It doesn't really, I know intuitively it seems like it would help and it would limit the scope of the audit, but it doesn't. And so I would not file returns while an audit's pending.
All right, moving on to, again, we're going to skip Melissa and Ken because those are tax-related questions. Moving on to Shakira. Shakira is asking, please brief on changes to first-time penalty abatement.
So the first-time penalty abatement program is mainly geared towards two kinds of penalties, failure to file penalty and failure to pay penalty. So with the failure to file penalty, a taxpayer could qualify for first-time penalty abatement if there are no penalties for the 3 tax years prior to the tax year in which the taxpayer received the penalty. But also the taxpayer should have filed all currently required returns or filed an extension of time to file so that there are no outstanding unfiled returns. And they should have paid or arranged to pay any tax due. So if they qualify for those 3 conditions, then they may qualify for the first-time penalty abatement, and that failure to file penalty would be abated. And if they didn't qualify for first-time penalty abatement, they may qualify for reasonable cause, which is that there was a reasonable cause on why that return was filed late. Either something was going on in their life that prevented them from filing it timely, or they relied on some professional help or information, and that professional help was incorrect, and the taxpayer suffered. Now, the failure to pay penalties continues to accrue until the tax has been paid. So if you're going to try to abate a failure to pay penalty, you would probably want to pay the tax first. So you would wait until the tax was fully paid, and then you would request the penalty relief under the penalty abatement policy And again, you would either qualify for the first time abatement or failing that for reasonable cause. And you would only do that after the tax has been paid. You can ask for the failure to file penalty while you're either in an installment agreement paying the tax or you've paid the tax. But you need to be in some kind of payment plan, or the tax needs to have been paid first.
All right. Thank you very much, Norma, for explaining the first-time penalty abatement program. Moving on to the next one is from Jeffrey. Jeffrey is asking, when preparing an OIC, the only asset the client has is an IRA account, roughly about $85,000, which is his only source of retirement. Can that amount be excluded based on hardship? What is the best way to handle this problem?
Okay, so what this doesn't tell me is how old is the taxpayer? I mean, the taxpayer could be young. That could be the money that he has set aside for retirement, but that he's not in retirement now, and he could be making a good living. I don't know. So I would have a better view if it said it's his only source of income, but I don't know that that's true or not. But if it was his only source of income, then rather than submitting an offer doubt as to collectability because the fair market value of the IRA account would be applied to the tax liability. And again, I don't know how much he's offered and how much tax is owed. Whether that $85,000 would make a dent or not. But there's another kind of offer, and it's called effective tax administration. And what that means is that even though the taxpayer has an asset with equity, like an IRA account or a home or a car or something, they need that asset, and they can't afford to pay the IRS the value of that asset. And so it's another way of going. And it's usually for people that are either elderly or some kind of medical condition or something, and it just wouldn't, it's kind of an equitable relief. It wouldn't be fair to take the equity from their home or take their equity from their IRA because that's their only source of income or whatever. And so there is a third option, but you really have to have a good reason on why the IRS shouldn't get the equity in that asset. And it would have to be something that the taxpayer absolutely needs but can't afford to give up.
Right. So effective tax administration could be a way out of this, Jeffrey, and hopefully, that explains it. If not, consider joining our VIP membership program, picking Norman's brain just a little bit more. He can walk you through step-by-step how to be able to be successful in this particular type of a case. So again, I do want to take this time to reiterate to everyone on the line that the VIP membership program is a great tool for those practitioners that are seeking additional support in dealing with any type of tax resolution case. We provide you with a lot of guidance, form review, consultation time, strategy. You can even use this consultation time for tax-related questions or even sales and marketing related questions. We have the support staff here to help you become a successful practitioner and taking forward your resolution practice to new stages. What do you get with the VIP membership program? So here's just going to read off of our website. If you check the chat box, I've already pushed a link that gives you the information to the different various VIP membership programs. Depending on which one you select or the level of membership you select, you get up to 3 hours of consultation time with any one of our professionals, practitioners, salespeople, marketing people to help you with your needs. You also get 20% off of everything site-wide. That includes textbooks, manuals, courses that you pay for. But if you do sign up for the annual membership, you do get a hardcover and a digital edition of the tax resolution textbook at no additional cost. You also get webinars and e-learnings that will be included. And not only are they a great source of knowledge and information, but you also get continuing education credits for that if you're a CPA, EA, or attorney. You also get access to our knowledge base, access to IRS forms in one location, and a lot more. So check out the link that I pushed on the chat box if you're interested in joining up as a VIP member. But you know what? As we do with everyone that joins us on a monthly basis, we always want to make sure we have a special offer for you. So if you're on the fence and you're unsure, we're going to give you a test drive. Go ahead and sign up for a VIP free trial, 2 month free trial of the membership. Take advantage of all the full access to the member section of our website, and use up to 1 hour of your consultation time during that free trial. So I'm sending you folks a link to that now. Take advantage of it. And again, as a reminder, you will get priority on these practitioners forum when you submit your question. All right, enough of that. Let's go ahead and move on to the second round of questions here. Norman, the next question is coming from Ephraim. Ephraim is asking, a prospective client claims that he has not filed returns in about 20 years. His fiance has made him come to his senses and refuses to marry him unless he takes care of this and becomes a normal taxpaying citizen. Talk about motivation, absolutely. My questions are, do we have to prepare all of the filed returns? And two, where do we begin to gather income information? He's held several jobs throughout this time and does not have records. I think transcripts, I can only get the last 6-7 years of wage and income. Your guidance is appreciated.
Okay, so one thing I would say is you probably should enter into a prenuptial agreement. I don't know what state they're in and whether or not they're subject to community property laws like here in California. But I would definitely, if I was the fiancé, I would definitely want to enter into a prenuptial agreement before marrying somebody with potential tax liability. The second thing is, do we have to prepare all unfiled returns? And I would say no, because first of all, if you can't get the information, how would you properly file them? And secondly, if the IRS hasn't prepared substitute for returns by now, there may not be a filing enforcement. By that I mean that the whatever information the IRS has on the taxpayer's income for those years may not be sufficient to require returns. So what I would do is I would concentrate on, when you say I can get transcripts for the last 6 or 7 years from wage and income, I think you can go back 10, I'm not sure. But first of all, I would get wage and income transcripts for whatever years you can get, and I would concentrate on those years, and I would prepare returns only for years that the taxpayer is required to file returns. And I would base the income on the wage and income transcripts. And I wouldn't worry right now about the years prior to that.
All right, Ephraim, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to the next one here is Roger. Roger's asking, I have a case that I took to appeals. I received a letter stating that they had accepted the appeal. That letter came almost a year ago, and I haven't heard anything since. Is there a way to follow up to see if a date has been scheduled? Do you know approximately how long it takes to get on the docket to hear a case that is being appealed?
Yeah, appeals is really hit and miss. Sometimes they get to it right away, and sometimes it takes a really long time to be assigned. But what I would do is, I believe that letter that you got has some phone number on it. I would call the number on the letter and say, you know, I got this letter a year ago and I haven't heard anything. I just want to make sure it hasn't fallen through the cracks. And they can tell you where it's at. So find that letter and call the number on it and ask them what's going on.
All right. And before I read the next question, I just want to let everyone know that we will be opening up to those live questions here in about two, three more questions that we have to go here. I see some of you have already submitted those, but keep them coming, and we will make sure we address those today. So next one is from Freddie. Freddie is asking, I appealed the audit findings from my client, and my appeal was denied. I want to take it one more step. Can a CPA petition the tax court? I may call you to discuss the particulars, as I don't feel the IRS is being fair with my client's audit.
Okay. A CPA can petition the tax court only if the CPA is admitted to practice in tax court. And my guess is that probably not, because attorneys can be admitted to tax court. It's not that difficult, and they receive a tax court bar number, which they need to use whenever submitting a petition. For instance, I'm admitted to tax court, and I have a tax court bar number, which is different from my state bar number. If you're not an attorney, you need to take an exam that's given every 2 years, has about a 10% pass rate, and is pretty extensive. So unless the CPA has taken the exam and passed and been admitted to tax court and been and received the tax court bar number, then they are not able to practice in tax court. The taxpayers could file a tax court petition on their own. The CPA could help them, but they would file the petition representing themselves. And then usually what happens is about 97% of tax court petitions never go to tax court. They're settled out of court. And so the case would probably get assigned to appeals office, and there'd be another look at it. And the taxpayers could go to the appeal, and they could bring their CPA to help them at the appeals conference. So that's the way that they would have to do it. It's not as good as having somebody who's admitted to tax court, because there are tax court rules that you need to follow. And just because you're a taxpayer representing yourself doesn't mean that the tax court's going to be any more lenient on making sure that you follow all the rules for status conferences and motions and other things that need to be filed that the taxpayers may not have the expertise with. But it is possible for taxpayers to represent themselves in tax court and have their CPA help them.
All right. Hopefully that helps you there, Freddie. Moving on to Marshall. Marshall is asking, can I request to have a revenue officer transfer a case outside of the client's local area? We are in South Dakota, and for this instance, would rather have an RO from LA or New York review my client's case, as I feel they will be more sympathetic to my client's lifestyle.
And a short answer is no. The reason they're called local revenue offices is because they're local to the taxpayer. Now, in some cases, because we represent taxpayers across the country, I've had the case assigned to a revenue officer near us because it's the power of attorney. But I don't think you could randomly request that it be assigned to a revenue officer either outside the area of the taxpayer or outside the area of the power of attorney.
All right, Marshall, I know what you were trying to do there, and we know what you're trying to do there, but it was a fair attempt there. Moving on to Jason. Jason is asking, if my client files for bankruptcy and has taxes discharged, will the IRS release the tax liens on real estate property?
So when you file a bankruptcy, even if the taxes are dischargeable, the IRS would have a secured claim And that's the secured claim would be the value of their liens. And the value of their liens is the value of the equity of the property in which the liens attach. So if there's a lien and they have equity in their home, or they have a car that they own free and clear, or other stuff in the bankruptcy schedules under real property and personal property, then that lien would remain. And the way to get that lien released is to negotiate with the IRS on releasing the liens, and you would argue about the value, and you would negotiate it, and the IRS will come up with a number, and if the taxpayer pays that number, the IRS would release the lien. Sometimes if the taxpayer's property is minimus and there really isn't much value to the IRS's lien, they'll just release it anyways because it really doesn't have any value. But if there is value to their lien, they're going to want some of that before they release it. So you need to negotiate with, it used to be called special procedures, now it's called the advisory group. So you would need to deal with them to determine the value of the IRS lien and what they would accept to release that lien.
All right, thank you, Norman. So I am opening it up to those of you who are on the line and wish to submit your question. So a lot of you have already done so, so I'm just going to start taking them up from the top here. So Irma is asking, client wants me to file 4 years delinquent returns because he knows he will owe for these years and wants to file a bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins. Can you explain the rules of discharging taxes? What is the waiting period?
Yeah, so the thing is, filing a bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins won't work because there's basically three rules. One is the three-year rule, and it has to be the taxes. The due date of the tax returns have to be more than 3 years before the filing of the bankruptcy. So if he wants to file 4 years returns, number one, I don't know how old, if they're the most recent 4 years or something else. But all those returns were due either April or October of the following year. And so it'd have to be 3 years from the due date of the return, which would be April or October of the year following the tax year of that return. Then there's a two-year rule, and you have to wait 2 years after filing a return. So the return would have to have been filed more than 2 years prior to the bankruptcy. So you can't really file bankruptcy less than 2 years after you file the returns. And the 280-day rule has to do with 280 days since the date of assessment. That's the date that the IRS actually assessed the tax based on the review of the return. So it's not that easy, and it's not that quick. They could become dischargeable in the future, but it may be 2 or 3 years down the road. It's not going to be as soon as collection activity starts.
All right. Thank you very much, Irma. Hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to Daniel, you are asking, does the state of New York have an offering compromise program? We successfully prepared an IRS OIC, but just found out that New York is going to garnish wages. What are the guidelines?
And so New York does have an offer and compromise program. We've used it and successfully obtained offers for our clients in New York. And it's pretty much the same as the IRS. And one thing about New York is they use the same form numbers as the IRS does. So you'd do the 656 and the 433 AOIC. But those are the New York forms. And I would go for it because we have been successful in obtaining offers and compromises in New York.
All right. Eve wants to know, can trust fund taxes be discharged in bankruptcy?
So trust fund taxes are assessed against the responsible person. So they're probably filing either a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13. Trust fund taxes are not dischargeable in a Chapter 7 because they're priority tax, and priority taxes aren't dischargeable in a Chapter 7. And in Chapter 13, they're also priority taxes, but they would have to be paid in the Chapter 13. So the Chapter 13 would be a five-year payment plan, and they would pay the trust fund taxes in the Chapter 13 over the five-year period. And one advantage would be that interest would not continue to accrue. So there'd be no continuing interest while they're paying it off in 5 years. But no, it's not discharged. It would survive a seven. And in order to make a Chapter 13 plan feasible, it would have to be provided for the Chapter 13 plan.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Shakarat online is asking, how do I submit an OIC 433B for a company that filed a final return in 2015? The OIC packets ask for most recent bank statements and financials, and those do not exist anymore. Will they automatically reject without those attachments?
So I'm not sure why you're submitting an offer for by a company. I don't know if you mean a corporation or if it's a, because if it's a sole proprietorship or a partnership, it would be, the tax would be assessed against the
individual,
the partners or the individual sole proprietor. So I'm not sure. And if it's a corporation and it's out of business, why would you be submitting an offer? And does it say what kind of taxes?
It doesn't say, but she is referring to, or Shakarat is referring to, a 433B. So we can assume it is a corporation. So Shakarat, if you can just click in and give us more information as the type of tax and why is it that you're trying to file an offer on 2015 liability or earlier than that for a corporation. We'll try our best to get those answers for you. Moving on to Melissa wants to know, does the first-time penalty abatement qualify for substantial understatement of tax for some income originally missing from the return that was originally filed?
So that penalty is the it's an accuracy-related penalty. I think it's 20%, and it doesn't qualify. It's not one of the first-time penalty abatement.
All right, Melissa, hopefully that answers your question there. This next one is Diana. She gives us a little background, so let me scroll to the top and read this for you. I have a client who has gotten behind on his payroll tax deposits and filings going back to December of 2017. I have been after him constantly to get these amounts paid, but he has not followed my advice. The balance due for all tax liabilities is close to $100,000 at this point. The business is not cash flowing and obviously hasn't been for a while. Against my advice, he continues to pay wages each week, but is not paying the current withholdings. I don't see a way out of this point and have told him that his best bet is to close the business down and find a job, but thus far he has refused to do this. I have repeatedly told him he will be personally responsible for these amounts and I am currently not doing any further work for him. My question is this, what liabilities will he be responsible for if and when he shuts the business down? I know the federal and state withholdings, will he be liable for the matching FICA and HI amounts as well?
So is it a corporation? As it just says, a business.
It says a business, yes.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's a sole proprietorship or a partnership or a corporation. So assuming it's a corporation and he shuts it down, he'd be liable for the trust fund recovery penalty, which, like we were saying, is usually around 50% of the payroll tax. And they're definitely going to assess that against him because this is the classic scenario where the company continues to pay other liabilities, but not the IRS. Also, they're continuing to accrue penalties for late filing of federal tax deposits and all kinds of things. So some people are better off being W-2 employees than running companies because they just get deeper and deeper into debt. And that's what's going to happen here. And then, you know, we're talking about a trust fund recovery penalty of $50,000 or more. And like I said, it's not dischargeable in bankruptcy. And he's going to end up having to pay it. So he's probably better off cutting his losses if he doesn't see a turnaround in business.
And I think that's what Diana's indicated here, that she's been urging him to take her advice and stop operation of the business because it's, like you said, just falling deeper and deeper in debt. All right, Diana, hopefully that helps you there. Now, Norman, you spoke about the CPAs taking the exam to be able to petition the tax court. I have a couple follow-up questions from different people wanting to know the process for EAs. Do you know practicing tax court? Is there a separate procedure for EAs to be admitted in tax court, similar to the process you described for attorneys and CPAs?
Attorneys are different from CPAs. I would think enrolled agents would be similar to CPAs. So you have to take, I would go to the U.S. Tax Court website and look for non-attorney admission because that you need to take that exam. You need to take a study course to prepare for the exam. And I think that exam is only given every 2 years. And I think 2018 is a year that they're giving the exam. I'm not sure when or if it's already been given. If it has, then it's not going to be given again until 2020. So you want to check it out and take the required course. And I know that there's a whole section on tax court procedure and stuff. So you need to know what court procedures are and stuff. And that can be pretty involved. So you definitely want to prepare. And again, I think only about 10% of people that apply and take that exam pass it and get admitted into practice.
Dirk just chimed in indicating that there's a test in November for this year. He says he knows two people that are taking it.
So you'd want to take a course and be prepared for that exam in November.
All right. Thank you very much, Dirk, for chiming in. Diana was following up to our answer. She did want to confirm it is an S corporation and thanks us for taking the question.
Yeah, so they're going to assess against him personally.
Right.
And the longer it goes on, the higher the assessment's going to be. At some point, it's going to be assigned to a revenue officer, and they may just wake up one morning and find their corporate bank account is wiped out.
And going back to Shakarat's question regarding the 433 OIC for the business of 2015 tax liability, he did respond, and let me read his follow-ups. He says the client is in bankruptcy and he has court ordered payments. The revenue officer wants to file trust fund civil penalty charges. Will this affect his bankruptcy? He is saying it's
okay,
a corporation.
So it doesn't say what chapter of the bankruptcy he's in. So I can't give you a definitive answer because different chapters have different rules because they have different objectives. But you can't file. Does this have to do with filing an offer?
Yes.
Yeah, you can't file an offer while you're in bankruptcy. So, you know, like if you go through the offer, the pre-submission checklist, it says, are you in bankruptcy? If you say yes, it says stop. So no, you can't file an offer while in bankruptcy. And if it gets assessed against an individual, it may affect, it wouldn't affect the 7, but it could affect the 13.
Okay, moving on. I'm sorry, I was reading Adam's question. Just submitted a question. He says, client age 40 owed the IRS about $97,000 for four tax years due to the wife's self-employment income. They entered into an installment agreement, but would like to evaluate whether an OIC is possible. They have no real estate and do not own assets other than the retirement accounts. They have less than $10,000 in savings. Due to expense reduction measures, they have a monthly positive cash flow. Their oldest son will begin college in 2 years. Their monthly payments towards rent and credit cards, including food, equates to about $4,300.
I mean, it's really hard to evaluate an offer on that. I mean, are they a member?
We have to double check, but I don't think Adam is a member yet.
Because one thing I offer to subscribers is to have them fax me a copy of the 433 AOIC or the 656 or whatever forms they're going to submit to the IRS and have me review it before submission so that I can help them tweak it to get the best results. Just a heads up, for instance, the fact that they're going to have a son go to college doesn't mean anything because none of the standard expenses provide for college expenses. That kind of has to be on your own. So that's not going to affect the disposable income test for an offer. So all I can tell you to do is complete the 433 AOIC. At the end of it, do the calculation and see what it comes up with, and subscribe so that I can help you.
Yeah, exactly. We are more than happy to do document review, give you our few pointers to be able to be more successful prior to submitting the package. And it looks like we have time for just one more, Norman. So Samuel is asking, my client just recently acquired a home healthcare business that has outstanding payroll tax liability. The previous owners have not been assessed, and I'm trying to negotiate a payment plan. The IRS wants to interview both the new owner and the old owner. Do I have a chance of having the IRS assess the new owner only? The business has the potential of being very profitable, so the new owner wants to contain the liability so it doesn't have to give up anything if the IRS assesses the previous owner personally.
Okay, so if you're talking about the 4180 interview, I guess, and the trust fund recovery penalty, the thing is they can't assess the trust fund recovery penalty against the new owner for periods that occurred prior to the new owner's ownership, because he couldn't have been a responsible person at that time because he wasn't there and he didn't have knowledge. He didn't have willfulness, and it wasn't his duty. So, yeah, they could assess the old owner trust fund recovery penalty, even though he's not involved in the business any longer.
Why don't you explain Status 63 to him?
Yeah, so Status 63 works if the responsible person who's been assessed the trust fund recovery penalty doesn't owe any other taxes, and the company has an installment agreement. So if the company's installment agreement is going to pay off the payroll tax liability, then they won't go after the responsible person, even though they've been assessed the trust fund recovery penalty. They'll collect all the trust fund and non-trust fund payroll taxes from the company. But that only works if, A, the company is in a installment agreement, and B, that the responsible person has no other tax liabilities.
Yes, I mean, I think your concern here is that the new owner will have to give up more if the old owners are being held responsible. So Status 63 might alleviate that situation, because as long as the company pays for the liability, they will not collect from the previous owners.
I mean, I'd be curious as to whether or not this purchase was a stock purchase or an asset purchase. That might have something to do with the analysis.
Right. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end here, Norman. I want to thank everyone on the line for submitting your questions ahead of time, and also for those of you that participated during the event. So we thank you. It always keeps it interesting when we get a lot of active questions to keep us current and making sure that those of you on the line are getting a good array of different questions so you understand what resolution is all about. So again, I want to remind everyone, our next practitioners forum is going to be on October 2nd. October 2nd is coming up, first Tuesday of the month of October. We want to thank you again for attending today's event. Please check us out at taxresolutioninstitute.org. I will also keep the links up on the chat box a few minutes longer after the event. So if you're interested in signing up for the VIP membership program, take a look, take it for a spin, 2-month free trial, no risk at all. So thank you very much again. We'll speak to you soon.